This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 200,000. That's today's number. As of today, more than 200,000 people in the United States have died from the coronavirus. In Massachusetts, that number is 9,107 as of yesterday. We are still groping our way through this. Mixed messages of when a vaccine might become available, changing directives from the CDC on whether the virus is airborne, deep disagreements on when, where, and how it's safe to be together, which means it is time to ask more coronavirus questions. What do you need to know? Do you have questions about vaccines, ventilation in schools, air filters, whether the virus will get worse in the cold weather, how much a flu shot matters? Ask our medical experts. Call now at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have a great panel today. Here to discuss is Dr. Davidson Hamer, professor of infectious diseases and medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine and a professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. Welcome back, Dr. Hamer.
Thank you very much.
Also with us is Dr. Rochelle Walensky. She's the chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Massachusetts General Hospital and a professor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School. Welcome back to you as well, Dr. Walensky.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, listeners, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dr. Hamer, what is your reaction to 200,000?
It's a little depressing, but it's not surprising given the challenges. I mean, how easy this virus is transmitted and the sort of variable implementation of control measures early in the epidemic and even in more recent months. And honestly, I think these numbers are under the real number, that there's probably a certain amount of estimates or underestimates of the total mortality associated with the virus.
So you think it's even worse, actually?
Yes.
Dr. Walensky, I'm going to play a piece of sound for you here. This is President Trump speaking to reporters in April.
I think we've done a great job. As you know, minimal numbers were going to be 100,000 people. Minimal numbers were going to be 100,000 people, and we're going to be hopefully far below that. If we didn't take quick action, you could have lost many millions of people.
So now here we are at double that minimal number, and a new estimate out of the University of Washington is predicting we could lose nearly 380,000 people from COVID-19 by the end of this year. We are at more than 20% of the COVID-19 deaths in the world, despite having less than 5% of the world's population. Why have we not been able to get a handle on this virus?
Well, I think there's been a lot of challenges in communication and a lot of tension both in politics and in that communication that has not led to a unified response. That unified response, listening to the science, listening to the data, being selfless in this somewhat selfish world right now, is really what we need to do. And in the absence of that, the virus is winning. I think, frankly, we wasted our summer. I mean, summer was the time to be outside. Summer was the time to control this. Summer was the time when respiratory viruses in general don't thrive as much. And we are now going into the fall, into cooler weather, into indoor times, at case rates that are twice what they were going into the summer. So I think we have real reason to be concerned. I wish I were surprised by 200,000. It's shocking, devastating, and tragic, but it's not surprising because we knew we were headed here with the numbers we were seeing.
Let's go straight to the phones now, 800-423-8255. Dan's on the line from Rockland. Hi, Dan. What's your question?
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm a survivor of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is an autoimmune response triggered by a varying number of things. But so my question is, as a Guillain-Barré survivor, I'm not supposed to be taking a flu shot because it could trigger a relapse. I'm wondering if there's any science or knowledge about any eventual vaccine and if that would be something that I would also try to have to avoid, or is there any thought on that?
Who'd like to take that one?
I'm happy to take that. I mean, Dan, this is a challenge. I mean, many vaccines have Guillain-Barré syndrome associated as a very rare side effect. And I think that out of caution, most vaccine manufacturers have recommended that anybody who's had that syndrome not receive a vaccine. I suspect it may be the same for the COVID-19 vaccine when and if, well, I guess when that becomes available. But, you know, it will be interesting to see. I mean, already there's been one rare allergic type response in one of the vaccine trials. And so it's going to be very interesting to track for, you know, rare, hopefully what will be very rare events and to see if Guillain-Barré syndrome arises during the use of the vaccine. But it may mean a, you know, a future challenge for you and other survivors of that syndrome.
Dr. Walensky, let's stay on the vaccine for a minute. One of the things that we know has been going on is some preparations for vaccine distribution when that time comes. Governor Baker said last week that high-risk groups like healthcare workers, people in communities of color who have suffered disproportionately from the virus would get first access to a COVID-19 vaccine when it becomes available. I'd like to know, you know, your reaction to those priorities, and is that consistent with how we've thought about vaccine distribution for other illnesses in the past?
Yeah, it's a great question. First of all, I want to just sort of emphasize that kind of prioritization has been, you know, thought through very carefully. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, the National Academy of Medicine have all been working together to figure out the best way to prioritize a vaccine when it becomes available. What I want to, and one of the emphases of the National Academy of Medicine was, in fact, not just vulnerable populations because of their comorbidities, other than diseases that they may have, but of the social vulnerabilities that they have had, because, in fact, we have seen just a huge discrepancy in people who are of lower socioeconomic status, of more marginalized communities, for those with this disease. And I think, right, very appropriately, we are looking to vaccinate those communities as a priority. That said, I want to be very cautious to sort of let people know that there's a lot of those people, of any of these high-risk communities out there. So 20 million healthcare workers in the United States. So we're going to need a lot of vaccine just to sort of think about the healthcare professionals, the essential workers, those with high-risk conditions, and those in these marginalized communities before we really feel like we've had enough vaccine, you know, out there.
Before I go back to the phones, Dr. Hamer, just one follow-up question on that. A new Pew Research poll finds that 49% of U.S. adults say they definitely or probably would not get vaccinated were it available today. So that means maybe 51% definitely or probably would. Is that number enough to get us to the level of immunity we need to be at?
Ooh, that's a tough question. I mean, there's been a lot of debate. I mean, I think early on, the estimates of sort of the level that you need to have to obtain herd immunity, where there's going to be no further continued transmission of the virus, were in the order of 2/3 to 3/4. More recent estimates, at least some that I've seen, suggest it may be lower than that, but if only about half of people are willing to take the vaccine, it's going to be a challenge to reach the point where we can safely open everything and not worry about continued transmission.
All right, let's go back to the phones here. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask Drs. Hamer and Walensky your coronavirus questions. They're here to answer them. Marie's on the line from Billerica. Marie, what's on your mind? What's your question?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I work as a personal care assistant to a physically disabled, very fragile child. I wondered how often I should be tested.
Sure. Dr. Walensky, is that something you think you can answer for Marie?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. First of all, thank you, Marie, for the question. I would say part of this is, first of all, obviously you want to protect yourself and you want to protect your patient and for the person for whom you're caring. Part of this is really about how much risk you feel like you are taking on a day-to-day basis. If you feel like you are able to appropriately mask, that you're living with people who are appropriately masking, they're not necessarily essential workers or high risk themselves. So really this is quite a bit about how much risk you feel like you might be at. Certainly people who are living in congregant settings and in other, in nursing homes, they're sort of looking at a frequency of screening. I don't necessarily think that healthcare workers who are protecting themselves properly need to have any kind of routine screening at all, assuming that they don't believe that they're in a high-risk situation.
Thank you for that. Let's grab Katrina from Lexington. Katrina, let me just put the number out, 1-800-423-8255. What's your question, Katrina?
Hi, thank you for taking my question. So what I'm looking for is, you know, after several months of airlines, you know, beefing up their safety measures and passengers being careful, do we have any actual data on the outcome of how safe it is to fly these days? Do we see higher rates of infections among people who are flying, or any kind of data-driven insight on that would be helpful?
It's a great question. And Dr. Hamer, I think it also weighs heavily on people's minds because we are now beginning to head towards the holiday season when people will want to fly if they can or drive, but probably fly in a lot of cases to see family. So what do we know?
So this is a very good question, an important question. And a lot of us have been wondering, you know, how safe it is to fly these days. There's been a recent analysis with data from several different sort of, I'd say, exposures on flights. And you know, there's one that was worrisome. That was Air Vietnam flight where a large number of people were infected on the flight, all notably in business class where they probably had more room and more distance between individuals. But then there have been a few other suggestions that of transmission on flights, but it's relatively limited. And I think it's not no risk, but I think it's low risk if the airlines are doing all the things they've described. If there is enough space on the flights, and again, you know, if they're filling, you know, the economy class with all three seats filled and not a space in the middle, that's going to be pretty crowded. But then also it's a function of what people are doing on the flight. If everyone's wearing a mask and paying attention to hand hygiene, in particular the mask use, you know, I think the risk is going to be lower. The challenge is on a longer flight where people need to eat or drink and they have to take their masks off, because that's the time when either if they're infected, they might be exposing others, or if somebody else is infected, they might be exposed. So, you know, I think that there's evidence that limited evidence of transmission on flights overall, and the measures that are being taken are helpful, but it's not a completely safe environment.
We are taking your coronavirus calls today with Dr. Davidson Hamer and Dr. Rochelle Walensky. The number to ask your call is 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Next, we have Mario on the line from Bedford. Mario, go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Hey, so the doctor said at the beginning of the segment that we lost the summer due to people being inside the home. But that was the government's initial response to the thing, was to do the lockdowns. Was that a counterproductive measure to the whole response? Thank you.
Dr. Walensky.
Yeah, Mario, thank you for that. Sorry, I meant to imply that we lost our summer in our inability to really control this virus nationally, and that usually if people are outside wearing masks and social distancing, that the summertime is really a time where respiratory viruses like influenza don't generally thrive. I do believe that the lockdown that we had in the springtime was essential for what we needed to do to control this. We had a massive amount of disease in our community, and our hospitals were overwhelmed. And I do think at that time we needed to shut down, lock down, and make sure that we were not contacting one another. As things have opened up, as there's been indoor dining, as there's been bars, and I don't just mean in Massachusetts, I mean across the nation, we have not been able to limit the spread during the summer, and that really would have been the time to do it.
Dr. Hamer, do you think we will see another period of lockdown here in the Commonwealth like we did last spring?
I cannot predict that, but I'm really quite concerned that this could happen. I mean, I think in Massachusetts in general, at least many parts of the state, people have been very cautious, both in terms of social distancing, public use of masks, and other measures. The challenge is that if you look at what's happening in a number of other parts of the world, Canada is seeing a surge of cases in Montreal and Quebec. Spain and France have had a big rise recently and to levels that were, you know, as bad or even worse than what they had in March and April. So they're clearly experiencing a second wave. Canada, at least parts of Canada, may be as well. And as Dr. Walensky said, you know, we're getting into the time of year where people are going to be spending more time inside. It's cooler out. You know, there's less ability to sort of, you know, diffuse the virus through natural airflow. And so the potential risk is going to increase. So I think we need to keep our guard up. If we continue to be careful, we may be fortunate and not have a second wave in Massachusetts. But if we do, then we're going to have to go into a more intensification of measures to try and control spread of the disease.
It has been a while since we've done an Ask the Doctors coronavirus call-in. You can call now at 1-800-423-8255 to ask your question. We've got Ted on the line from Dorchester. Ted, go ahead. What's your question?
Yes, I'm wondering, are we in flu season yet? And how does that influence whether or not you should have a COVID test?
That's a great question, Ted. Dr. Walensky, do you want to, or whoever just chuckled gets to grab that one.
We probably both did. I don't think we're really there yet. We are preparing for it for sure, and that means everybody should be out getting your flu vaccines in preparation for it. Typically, we see flu peak in the December, January, February timeframe, and so we want to make sure people are vaccinated so that the vaccine is working and gives you good protection by the time we have that flu season come. When flu season gets here, it's going to be tricky, especially if we have a lot of flu, and that is because coronavirus very much looks like influenza, and there certainly have been cases of people who have had both coronavirus and influenza. So it's really going to be important for people to, you know, get your flu vaccine, try and protect yourself as much as you can for at least one of these diseases. What I will say, however, in all of that, is that the same measures that protect you from coronavirus will also protect you from the flu. So we are really hoping that this year, in addition to sort of widespread flu vaccination and getting that message out, that the hand washing, the distancing, the mask wearing will protect people both from the flu as well as from coronavirus. But indeed, when you present with symptoms that look like flu or coronavirus, you may very well get tested for both.
And Dr. Walensky, just briefly before I go back to the phones, what about people who are concerned to enter into a healthcare environment to get a flu shot because they're worried about getting sick in the healthcare environment?
I will say that there have been now numerous studies that have demonstrated that we now know that mask wearing works, both in terms of transmission of healthcare workers to one another and from patients to healthcare workers and from healthcare workers to patients. So our doors are wide open. It is safe to come back. We want to see you. We want you to come back, and we certainly want you to get your flu shot.
Okay, let's take another
call.
Absolutely.
Can I just add something to that really quickly? And that is that you know, pretty much all hospitals now have a policy of providing masks to visitors, encouraging hand hygiene and other measures that are going to really minimize the risk of exposure in a healthcare setting. So I agree. You know, it's definitely safe for patients to come back.
And I have to say, I got my flu shot on Saturday and felt completely safe doing so, in and out very quickly. It's not a scary step to take, and it is an important one this year. We've got Winona on the phone from Winchester. Winona, what's your question?
Thank you. I am calling with concern that the issue by CDC that was published,
It's okay, Winona.
Aerosol spread of the virus, you know, with breathing, coughing, sneezing, what, all of those, that obviously it is a scientific fact. And the fact, and now that CDC has been inappropriately advised by the leadership of our country, that that will be withdrawn as a method of spread.
So, Winona, I'm going to help you with that, just to kind of clarify for our listeners. So at the end of last week, the CDC put up guidance referring to possible spread, airborne spread, and then removed that guidance. I believe it was the end of the day yesterday. So let's turn that to Dr. Hamer. I'm glad you raised that, Winona. That was something I was hoping we were going to talk about today. Dr. Hamer.
Yeah, no, I agree, Winona. I fully share your concerns about this. I mean, it's complex. We've learned a lot about transmission of SARS-CoV-2 over the last few months, and we now recognize that it's can be spread through aerosol. That at least there is an aerosol generated by people who are infected. And that can spread beyond just the sort of 6 feet that we've been using. Large respiratory droplets, which occur with breathing, but especially with coughing or sneezing, tend to drop down to the ground after, you know, 3 to 6 feet. But there's a lighter aerosol that can go much further. It can go several, you know, 9, 12 feet even. And I think CDC was making a comment about this. But all of these, you know, in order to prevent exposure to these, you know, mask use is really critical. I personally have great concerns about what's happening with oversight of the CDC. I mean, CDC has a lot of smart people. They put a lot of thought in their guidelines, and to post something and then to have it rescinded days later is, you know, I think inappropriate. It's almost censorship, really. And it conflicts, you know, I think their initial data, you know, are really trying to use the best available information, and there's more and more information that's been generated in recent weeks or months on aerosols and the fact that they are infective, that you can actually culture live virus from the aerosols, and there's definitely a risk. So it's unfortunate that they've had to, you know, that this has happened.
So I'm going to build on that and ask you, Dr. Walensky, okay, but if it starts to raise concerns that we can't trust the information coming from the CDC, so I guess the dot, dot, dot on that is, tell me we can still trust the information coming from the CDC and where else people should turn for reliable information other than when we get lucky enough to have the two of you on the show to answer questions.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I think I'm with Dr. Hamer in that it's just it's dejecting, actually, because I think both of us and the whole scientific community knows lifelong public servants, incredible scientists, researchers, and colleagues who live at the CDC and are doing incredible work there. And same is true for the FDA, I will say, because I know that this discussion not only speaks to the, you know, what's happening at the CDC and the public facing statements from the CDC, but also those of the FDA. I think we in the scientific community are, you know, looking to science now. We're looking to primary literature. We're looking to people who we know are the public servants who have done the scientific work, and trying to sort of separate the wheat from the chaff in terms of the messaging of it. But this is going to get tricky. I've been, you know, looking more to the NIH now than the CDC or the FDA, perhaps. But I think, you know, especially as we think about the public messaging of how this virus is transmitted, and then in the future about how vaccines, this has really been on everybody's mind, you know, when is the vaccine safe, efficacious, and ready to use, I will be looking to the scientific data rather than necessarily the statements from the FDA.
And Dr. Hamer, we have to say goodbye to you too momentarily, so I can't take any more calls, but there was one saying, if you're asymptomatic, will you always be asymptomatic? Is there like a yes or no answer you could give to that?
There's a sort of mixed answer. I mean, some people remain asymptomatic, and we think it may, you know, be age related, with younger people, you know, maintaining an asymptomatic state through their whole infection more commonly than older people. And there are probably other risk, other factors, but clearly some people, when they're tested, may be asymptomatic to begin with, and then after 1 to 4 days develop symptoms. And that's what's known as a pre-symptomatic phase of infection. And that's so not everybody stays asymptomatic.
All right, that is Dr. Davidson Hamer, Professor of Infectious Disease and Medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having us.
And Dr. Rochelle Walensky, Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Massachusetts General Hospital. Thanks to you, too.
Thanks so much for having me.
A new report released by Citizens for Juvenile Justice just last hour is making the case to remove police officers called school resource officers from Massachusetts schools. For more, we are joined by the executive director of the group, Leon Smith. Leon, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And Leon, before we start our discussion, I just want to note we did reach out to the Boston Public Schools, to Mayor Walsh's office, and the National Association of School Resource Officers to invite them to participate in this conversation, but we didn't hear back from them in time for the show. What is the difference, Leon, between, let's just start here, between a school resource officer and other police officers, and how common are these school resource officers in Massachusetts?
Well, a school resource officer is a police officer that is actually placed and stationed inside of a school. So this is not a situation where an officer is patrolling the community, they receive a call, and then they respond to the school. They're in a school all the time. So that effectively is the difference, and they are rather common across the Commonwealth.
Do you have any sense of the numbers? I see a report from 2015-2016 that 48% of high school students and 33% of middle school students attended a school with a police officer.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so as we lead towards your findings, I just want to understand, how do we get to the point where that many of our students are in schools with a police officer assigned in the school?
Well, there's a long history, and when you look at the issue of school, of police officers in school, there really is a racialized history that dates all the way back to integration. The first police officers in schools were in the 1950s in Flint, Michigan, in response to Brown versus Board of Education, and it was really about a lot of rhetoric around black and brown children being dangerous delinquents and undesirable who would bring, quote, disorder to white schools. And over the years, into the 60s and 70s, we've continued to see the growth in school resource officers placed, especially in predominantly black and brown schools, really culminating after Sandy Hook took place. So in 2012 in Massachusetts, the Commonwealth passed the Gun Violence Reduction Act, which effectively mandated the district to sign at least one school resource officer unless they went through a waiver process. So that's sort of the history.
So most recently, it was concern about school shootings, the legacy of school shootings. Since 2012 in Massachusetts, that's been our driver.
Yes, but interestingly enough, that is often quoted as a reason for, but when we looked at the data from our report, we found that there was little convincing evidence that the presence of an armed police officer had much of an effect on school safety at all. We looked at
So I was just going to say, just for listeners, your report actually has a giant F in red on the cover, which is damning. So take us briefly through those findings. Yes.
Absolutely. So, first, we always hear we need police officers in schools because what about a school shooting? Well, we looked at a meta-analysis, which took 12 studies, and none of them indicated a positive impact of police presence on school safety outcomes. Furthermore, in 2018, the Washington Post looked at nearly 200 incidents of gun violence on campuses and could only find 2 times where an SRO successfully intervened in a shooting. So effectively, although the school shooting argument is often made, proof that it works isn't really backed up, as we only seem to be effective in 1% of those occurrences.
So what, just for listeners, SRO is a school resource officer. What kind of outcomes would you have expected to see in your meta-analysis had placement of school resource officers in schools been successful or effective, according to your organization?
Certainly higher than 1% is what I would say.
So higher than 1% of shootings being prevented? Is that what you're talking about?
Certainly. I mean, but, you know, it's thrown out as an argument and a justification, but when you look at the actual data, it is nowhere near as effective as I think some people would think. You know, some of our other findings, it really gets to the point that, you know, people equate safety in schools with the placement of police. But when you look at the research, there isn't data to back up that a police officer in schools really makes them safer, but there are a number of negative effects of police officers being in schools. We see that what happens when you have an officer in school all of the time is that low-level, nonviolent behaviors that have historically been handled through the school disciplinary system are suddenly being criminalized. And that criminalization of lower level, often typical adolescent behaviors fall disproportionately on Black and brown students and on students with disabilities. And, you know, part of the reason why is what is considered subject to school discipline, being sent to the principal's office, versus what's considered, you know, criminal or delinquent or something where the school police officer should be brought in, those lines are so blurred that even SROs aren't clear on them. We have situations right here in the Commonwealth where in one town a certain behavior is handled by school discipline, and in the next town over, it can be subject to an arrest. And that creates a great deal of disproportionality, which is a major argument for why we really should not have police officers in schools.
So a couple of questions there. Your report was just released an hour ago. This is really fresh. Did you preview your findings with anyone who might push back or disagree on them? And if you did, what has that response been? And if not, have you heard any critical responses yet? As you heard, we had invited some guests to join us, but we did not get responses before the show.
We just released a report today. But what I will say is that we believe that our research is sound, and we certainly welcome the discussion. We stand by our statistics. We stand by our data. We stand by the research, which we did in conjunction with Strategies for Youth, another Massachusetts-based nonprofit. And we certainly welcome the opportunity to talk about these issues with anyone.
You know, we talked about the fact that after 2012 in the Commonwealth, the concern in part in bringing school resource officers in was a school shooting like Parkland or Sandy Hook, these tragic shootings. The report points out that if there were not school resource officers in the building, that a school could still call 911 in an emergency situation. Mm-hmm. And I found myself thinking, isn't there some benefit to having someone in the building to respond to that kind of emergency who knows the building, knows the students? Might they actually escalate less than what a 911 call to a precinct might produce?
Well, first of all, I think we have to acknowledge that those types of serious incidents are far and away the exception and not the rule. So what happens now when you have officers that are stationed in a school is the officer standing there observing students every day. And again, you have just typical adolescent behaviors, kids clowning around, kids being kids, which ends up being criminalized. Furthermore, there are situations where young people, they're talking, they're having conversations. There's really no privilege or as it pertains to a police officer listening in, thinking about the recent situation in Boston where observations and overheard conversations amongst young people ended up in a gang database and ended up creating not just the school-to-prison pipeline, but the school-to-prison-to-deportation pipeline. So what happens when you build an entire policy around the type of occurrence, this rarity, you know, one, those things often they don't often happen.
But so you're building to daily, the exception.
But then the daily reality is that you're creating a negative school climate. We've seen that negative school climate leads to less positive academic outcomes. And in some cases, you're literally, the presence of that officer has a traumatizing rather than a comforting effect on a lot of students, especially in the times that we're in right now.
Let's stay on that, because that was really striking, Leon. Your report discusses racial differences in whether school officers create a sense of safety. And in it, it says that one Tulane study found that 69% of white students said they felt safer in the presence of police, while only 40% of black students said the same thing. And I found that really striking after last week when the Supreme Judicial Court ruling said that nervous and agitated, quote unquote, behavior among black citizens could no longer be considered suspicious behavior by police, given the data suggests it might be a rational response for a black person to be nervous around the police. So are we seeing mirrored in the school resource officers and their interactions in schools the same questions and concerns we're having about interactions between our black community and peace and police on a larger scale?
Absolutely. I mean, our schools do not exist in a bubble. They exist within our communities where incidents of police abuse and police brutality happen. They happen on camera and they happen off camera. And young people see this. They know people in their family who've had these experiences. Sometimes they themselves have been stopped and frisked and patted down. And they certainly have access to technology where they see what's happening, not just to adults. We must always remember that the modern Black Lives Matter movement really started with two teenagers, Trayvon Martin and Mike Brown, who were the victims of this sort of violence. So you have situations. One, police brutality has been a reality in the black community for nearly 100 years. The first march against police brutality happened in 1919. This is not a new occurrence. But, you know, being in an era where on social media, on the news, you're consistently seeing these things happen. And a lot of these young people, I draw upon my experience as a defense attorney for 19 years, they endure these behaviors as well. And then they go into school and then they see an officer. That's not a comforting sight. Double that with the study by a recent study that was conducted that showed that when particularly black males, have frequent contact with law enforcement, and that contact is intrusive, meaning they're stopped, they're patted down, or they are searched, they have increasing levels of anxiety and trauma up to post-traumatic stress disorder. You have young people.
I'm sorry, Leon. I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I'm going to have to end us there. I do need to leave time for the last segment on the show. But it was great to have you, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us more about this.
Anytime.
That's Leon Smith, Executive Director of Citizens for Juvenile Justice. Stay tuned. There's more ahead. Today, Sudbury police announced that they are charging two parents and their teenager under the state's social host law. At issue, the family allegedly hosted a party at their private residence where police say at least 50 minors consumed alcohol. And as a result of the party, Lincoln Sudbury Regional High School switched to all remote learning for 2 weeks. And therein lies the rub. Now, normally a high school party isn't the type of news story we'd cover, but this isn't normally, and the decision by the Sudbury police raises an interesting question. Would the police have charged this family anyway? They did break the law. Or is this a sign of a new phase in the pandemic? Will we start turning to civil and criminal law to compel each other to coronavirus compliance? Now, tomorrow we're going to take your calls on how you are feeling about and navigating the need or the desire to be social during the pandemic. But today we want to explore this legal question and the status of personal freedoms during this public health crisis. Joining us to do so is civil liberties attorney Harvey Silverglate. Harvey, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be back after a while.
So, Harvey, I want to note that we don't know much beyond what I've already said about this particular case. But even with the information we have, what do you make of it? Any sense that this might be the shape of things to come?
Well, I think this is the shape of things to come while the pandemic is raging. I don't think that it's going to result in any permanent change in the law. But, you know, law accommodates extraordinary circumstances. And when the extraordinary circumstances disappear, the law usually, or at least it's supposed to, go back to being what it was before the emergency. And the law is not blind to the realities out on the street. And so while ordinarily the police would have no say about such a gathering as you were just describing, in a pandemic, the police and the state do have something to say, and they say it. And if the if their commands are disobeyed, they will proceed with the criminal charge. So we're extraordinary times for civil liberties and criminal law.
I want to ask you a couple of questions based on that. The first is, so in this case, there was law that covered the illegality of the party from a drinking standpoint. The question is whether the COVID aspect of it was really what motivated the police to act. Is it unusual in a public health crisis like this? And these are accusations. We don't, you know, there hasn't been a trial. Nobody has been convicted.
Yep.
In a situation like this, do we see the use of existing law applied in new ways for public health?
Well, first of all, I doubt very much that the police would have made such a big fuss over just the underage drinking. I think it was a combination of the underage drinking, but more importantly, it was the gathering without face masks in close proximity, without social distancing, of a group of people during a pandemic where the governor has issued orders prohibiting such gatherings.
So that's the other question. With the pandemic, the governor and other governors have asserted this power. You called it extraordinary circumstances a couple of minutes ago. We are seeing some pretty significant protests around the country and around the world pushing back on restrictions to behavior. I'm thinking about the armed people lining the walls of the Michigan State House back in the spring, the anti-mask rally in Utah in August, that footage of it went viral last week. And then, you know, there have been anti-mask protests in London, Melbourne, Rome, Madrid. Where is the line between public health and civil liberties? And is this pushback appropriate in this moment, or is it overly fearful of a kind of a crackdown that's not going to permanently threaten people's sense of freedom and way of life?
Okay. Let me put it this way. The law allows you pretty much to do to yourself whatever it is you want to do. You want to eat unhealthy food, you can eat unhealthy food. If you want to not brush your teeth and lose all your teeth in your 20s, you can do that. The law doesn't stop you from self-inflicted wounds, if I can use that term. But the problem with the pandemic is that if you don't take care of yourself, you are likely to have a very destructive impact on somebody else next to you. So if you have the COVID and you get close to somebody, you know, within 6 or 8 feet, you are endangering that person if you don't have a mask. And so it's not just a problem of the law forcing you to take care of yourself. The law is forcing you to not inflict damage on other people. And that's the rub. So ordinary, you know, a civil libertarian, and I consider myself to be a very strong civil libertarian, I would say that the state has no right to keep you from hurting yourself. But it does have a right to keep you from hurting somebody else. And that's the problem. This is a very painful period for people who believe in liberty and who believe in strict limitations on the power of the state.
You said at the beginning, you talked about, you know, we're in these extraordinary circumstances. You didn't have a concern that when the extraordinary circumstances were over, that we would continue to see use of the law in this way. I found myself thinking, okay, but who says when the extraordinary circumstances are over? How do we know when we're out of that moment and continuing crackdowns aren't appropriate and shouldn't be happening? I can just hear the slippery slope concern in a listener's mind on this.
Well, there's always a slippery slope concern whenever we allow the government to exert enhanced powers. And it's really a matter of being very observant, following things carefully, looking at the science. Ours is a society that places a strong reliance on science in order to determine when the emergency, when the crisis is over. And then civil libertarians and anyone who cares about freedom has to push back hard to make sure that the government, which asserted these extraordinary powers, drops them, you know, disasserts them, and goes back to the status quo before the emergency.
Do you think that there will be a long tail on any of this? So, for example, I never took my shoes off in an airport before 2001, and I will take my shoes off in an airport for the rest of my life. We think differently now about FISA warrants or other aspects of the Patriot Act that have become part of our everyday existence after 9/11. Is there anything that you think will change between the law and public health that may change permanently?
I don't think so, because this is very different from 9/11. The threat of terrorism and bombs planted on and explosive devices taken onto airplanes is I think that's forever. But the nature of a pandemic is at some point it either burns itself out or there's a vaccine. We've had epidemics in the past. I was a young kid when there was a polio epidemic. There were certain steps taken. When the polio epidemic passed, the steps were no longer necessary, and they disappeared. So we have to be vigilant to make sure that government doesn't use this as an excuse to retain enhanced powers. And I think that that especially in Massachusetts, you know, which has a long history of being a little bit suspicious of government overreach, I think we'll be okay.
So last question for you then, Harvey. Are you comfortable with, and do you think right now we have the right balance between use of the law to preserve us in this public health moment and our civil liberties? It sounds to me like you're saying you're comfortable with the balance that we have in place.
Well, you're using the word that I don't usually use to describe myself, comfortable.
Which is comfortable.
Am I comfortable? No. Do I think that the government has asserted about as much power as it needs currently? Yes, I'm okay with that, but I always prefer to keep my eyes open. What's the old expression? Trust but verify. I'm trusting the government on this one, but I'd like to keep my eyes open and verify.
And that is Harvey Silverglade.
That's perfect. Does that sound okay?
It does. Puts me at ease, Harvey. Harvey's an attorney specializing civil liberties. Harvey, thanks for coming on today.
My pleasure.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Jimmy Kiesling. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tisiana Deering. Thanks for listening today, and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.